This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 6th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Parcel. Hello and welcome to the 156th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, in association with Parcel. Now, after the tightly themed show from last week on handwriting, we're switching about today like a snake in a sack. We didn't just want to go in one direction, so we're going in these. We'll speak to the people behind what might well be your favourite film magazine, Little White Lies, as they make their beautiful bi-monthly into a hardback book.
We hope that it does become like, you know, a modern day version of the Encyclopedia Britannica for film.
We'll speak to one of the world's preeminent art writers, Sarah Thornton, about her wonderful new book, Investigating the Cult of the Artist.
The general public tends to confuse artists with craftsmen. The art world knows that contemporary artists are more ideas people who could be delegating the execution of the work and may not even see it until it arrives at the gallery.
And we'll throw off the shackles of the studio to head to Rio, but to go to the cinema. It's the film festival de Rio.
I think Brazilian film industry is very sophisticated. It's very good. There's a lot of talent here.
Plus, we'll hear why we should go to Spiritland. It's a night out, not a place, for all our high-end listening requirements. We'll meet the sculptor of Pinhead Sculptures, he of the safest hands in the West, and we'll enjoy a Midori House session from Rue Payne's. Folky, that'll be. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll begin, as ever, with a track from this week's Midori House session. Rue Payne's is a folk musician who hails from the south coast of England. His music is delicate, yet catchy, laid-back but soulful. Since 2012, he's put out three EPs, but this week sees the release of his debut full-length album, Little Giants. Rue dropped by Monocle HQ, armed with his guitar, to play a few tracks from that record. And here he is first with Tiger Striped Sky.
Pouncing right away through the devil shadows. Light was pouring down upon the stepping stones. Felt like morning coming for his throne. I don't know why, but it felt like in tiger striped sky. Half the world was pulling on his collars. As night surrendered day into the hours. Glow was calming down, calming down. I don't know why, but it felt like a tiger striped sky. Oh, tell me why I'm underneath a tiger striped sky. Oh, tell me why I'm underneath a tiger striped sky. I'm tired of seeing adventures on a cafe wall. I think I'll take a turn from the known road. Think I'll write a tale of my own. I'm going southbound to where the ocean's flirting with the coast. Oh, tell me why I'm underneath the tiger striped sky. Oh, tell me why I'm underneath the tiger striped sky. up my stripes, painting with new colors, beginning the dove white. Oh, I'll be giving up my stripes, painting with new colors, beginning the dove white.
That was Rue Paines with Tiger Striped Sky, and there'll be more of that later. You know how it works. Now, first today, we're going to look at how the people behind one of our favourite magazines took the soft cover concept and turned it into a hardback book, something not unknown to us editors here at Monocle. Little White Lies is the movie magazine for aesthetes. The bi-monthly Buff's Bible has been commissioning beautiful illustrations and asking those all-important, interesting questions since 2005. And now they've teamed up with Faber and Faber to go heavy duty. Their book, What I Love About Movies, is out now, and I spoke to Little White Lies editor David Jenkins and creative director Timber Smits about moving from the newsstand to the bookshelf.
I think with the magazine, it's very much our own sort of personal fiefdom that we can do whatever we want. It's a bit of a playground. We can have meetings, we can have ideas and just execute them as and when we like. Obviously, a book is a collaboration with a wider group of artists and people and producers and editors and publishers, and there's a lot more enforced communication and actually, enforced communication sounds bad, but more like just communication.
Someone coming in and saying you will reply to your email.
Yes.
David. I get that.
It's interesting. You definitely have to be a lot more organized, I think, because there's a lot more people at the table.
This is, in a sense, I get the feeling it's a bit of an aggregate in terms of words and the layouts and illustrators that you use. Because your magazine's famous for commissioning these wonderful illustrators and really getting under the skin of the movie before it's come out, and people kind of really know what it's about, especially. The book is a different kind of project, as I said. It's maybe an aggregation of some of your styles. It's a bit of a... Is it a greatest hits? Is it a bit like that?
Yeah, I would...
Is it a DVD box set?
Encyclopedia, like a Bible. <I don't
know. laughs> The Rosetta Stone.
But there is...
I'm getting a bit of a Holy Grail with...
There is volume one printed on the front of the book.
And I like that.
We were kind of forward thinking with it. So we hope that it does become a modern day version of the Encyclopedia Britannica for film.
And we should say it's called What I Love About Movies. And this is this is the last question you asked for your subjects in the magazine, isn't it? Mm-hmm. This is obviously, I think you call it the kind of the hearty digestif at the end of the meal in terms of when you're doing an interview with somebody, David. Was the book ever going to be about anything else, or is that always the killer? What I Love About Movies is obviously such a good question to ask all these cinematic luminaries that you've got between the covers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was more to do with the fact that we just realized after a while that the subjects were giving such great answers. It is a weird question because there is a sort of existential hue to it where you're sort of asking someone, why are you doing what you're doing?
It's a really nice, as an interview as well. I think directors always get asked such kind of, they get questions that always are trying to show the journalist's knowledge rather than just being asked a really straight question, asking an artist why a painting is blue. Mm-hmm. They never get asked that and they quite like answering it, right?
Never ask a question that doesn't always make the subject think that you've seen their film. So you've nothing generic, like what were your influences or what was it like working with actors or anything like that. It's always something, you have to always ask something specific about the film. This was obviously an exception to that. But I think because it's such a big, broad question in terms of its scope, and I think people like to think of, it's also sort of very multi-layered as well, because you can talk about actual movies, what I like about movies, what I like about the movies as in the industry.
Their movies, like, other people's movies.
What I like about my own movies, what I like about directing.
Or
a memory. Yeah. And I mean, I think the book actually comes from all those angles. And I mean, I think that's what's really nice. People who make movies are all thinking about it in different ways.
And in terms of the illustrations, Timber, in terms of the visual feel of the book, the layouts and things, did you have to wait before the answers came in to know what to do? Or did you kind of think, aha, I think we've got in front of us Wes Anderson, for example. We know what he's famous for. We know what he's done. We know what he's working on next. So we can kind of, we can do an amalgamation of sort of his oeuvre as it is.
Well, because the book is a mix of pre-existing answers to the questions, I was able to send a lot of them out to the illustrators. And the question was proposed to them, like, if you can, try and reference, you know, some of what the personality is saying in their quote to your illustration. But then a lot of them, we didn't have that, you know, so the illustrators were kind of, you know, basing their drawing or their artwork based off that person alone. But also, you know, the illustrators were picked, you know, very carefully, like looking at their work and looking at the style of the personality, whether they be an actor or a director in the style of their films, and just matched like quite carefully. So that was a big process. You know, it's 50 illustrators in the book. So
yeah.
A lot of research and development went into that.
Because I'm wondering that with picking an illustrator for a director or an actor or whoever you have in here, whether you want to find something that suits the director's kind of vibe or whether you want something that can be jarringly against it sometimes. What the temptation is a creative director commissioning these illustrators.
Yeah, well, we wanted a mix of that as well in the book. So you've got a couple that are, you know, just sort of right on the money. Take Wes Anderson's, for example. You know, Andrew Fairclough, who goes by the name of Kindred Studio.
Mm.
He really took like the personality of like Wes Anderson's kind of, you know, mid-century kind of style of his films and all of his little details and textures and really built this world. Whereas some of the other illustrations, yeah, sure, I put illustrators with a completely like different style to the director or the actor to see what they would do as well, just to add a bit of an element of surprise to the book.
I think one of the things I like, I mean, you had it opened on a page just previously, the director, Taiwanese director called Tsai Ming-Liang.
Oh yeah, here he is.
Who's quite, you know, he's maybe sort of lesser known director than someone like Wes Anderson.
And that's a lovely illustration.
It's one of my favourites.
Jensine Ekwall has done that.
But what I love about that is that, I mean, you really get the sense that through watching a couple of the director's films, doing some research, she totally nailed the essence of his movies.
Mm.
You know, it is. Yeah. I mean, all his movies are covered, you know, have people trudging around in water and, you know, they're very kind of water-based. And I think this, the image he's created to capture his world.
I'd have that on my wall without even knowing anything about what it was about or who he was. I think that's absolutely beautiful.
And I think that's another, you know, secret to the book is if you're not familiar with the director, if that illustration, like from a creative point of view, if that illustration pulls you in, like you're going to read that quote, you're going to study that director's films and you're going to, you know, kind of...
Yeah, that makes me want to watch his films. I've heard of him, but I'm not familiar with his movies, but that would make me want to watch him because it's strange, isn't it?
We wanted it to sort of almost come across as a sort of leveller where we had directors like Tsai Ming-Liang sat next to directors like Wes Anderson.
Mm.
And, you know, I think kind of riding on the nature of the question is that cinema movies is this kind of overarching thing that does connect these weird personalities who you may think this person makes completely different movies to this kind of person, but actually there is kind of shared DNA there. So I think this book is definitely meant to be a reflection of, you know, it's not just art house directors, it's not just me. You know, we've got Christian
Stewart in
there. You
haven't just chosen your big boys, have you? You've chosen presumably people that give the best answers.
It's just the people we love, really. You know, it's just the directors who, you know, we obviously spend all day, every day watching movies, and, you know, these are just the people who we want to celebrate.
That was David Jenkins and Timber Smits from Little White Lies magazine, and their book, What I Love About Movies, is out now and it's published by Faber & Faber. We now make our way down to Brazil to Latin America's largest film festival, Festival do Rio. A total of 350 films from 75 countries are shown on 30 screens at this year's festival. And for the second time running, they've added a conference component, which acts as a marketplace for TV and film professionals to rub shoulders. This is all part of Brazil's attempt to make its mark as a global player in the film and television industry. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, made the rounds at the Festival do Rio to see how Brazil's audiovisual industry is looking to expand its reach.
A buzz fills the air at Rio Market, but this is a side of Festival do Rio that many don't see. But here at Rio Market, the movie machine is at work, with producers, entertainment lawyers, and even accountants circulating about. All of them looking for business contacts for the next big project. Although the Brazilian film and television market is still small, it's growing. Between 2009 and 2013, Rio Filmi, the city's audiovisual secretariat, invested 145 million reais, about 58 million US dollars, into some 375 projects that produced around 33,000 jobs. How the industry is doing that here is mostly through co-productions, which is fittingly today's theme at Rio Market. Ken Dhaliwal, an entertainment lawyer from the Toronto-based firm Dentons, explains how international co-productions between two countries can not only help boost a nation's soft power image, but how co-productions make high-budget films happen.
I think the industry in Brazil has realized, like industries in other places, that a co-production is actually a very good way to share costs and to share risks. Because making a movie and making a TV show is very expensive, very difficult to do. So if you only get the money from one place, and you only have talent from one place, and ideas from one place, your chances of success are not necessarily that good. But if you can access money from two places, and resources from two places, or even three places, you can make something that's potentially more marketable and accessible outside of just Brazil. So it has a more of an international feel. That's a very important part of the way the industry is proceeding, because the reality is there's just not that much money available to make these things, and TV and film are very expensive. So accessing the incentives or the co-production structures actually makes a lot of sense.
A perfect example of a successful co-production is Festival do Rio's closing film, Trash. Filmed entirely in Brazil, Trash has a star-studded cast and crew. Directed by Billy Elliot director Stephen Daldry and teaming famed Brazilian actors Walter Moura and Celton Mello with the likes of Hollywood great Martin Sheen, the film is a good example of how a Brazilian story can be told through the power of co-production.
O Santos é corrupto e a gente não vai ficar impune para sempre.
A collaborative effort by Brazil-based large-scale production company O2 Filmes, with working title Peepai Films and Universal Pictures, Trash tells a fictitious story of corruption in Brazilian politics. Two trash collectors find a wallet that's very important to a politician, who will stop at nothing to get the wallet back in order to not have any of his wrongdoings exposed. Although the story is a bit far-fetched, the drama does reference the real-life battle Brazilians face with the country's politicians. Trash debuts at the closing of Festival do Rio, and it's expected to be Brazil's next big blockbuster success. But Festival do Rio isn't just screening big-budget productions and attracting big business players. Co-productions have attracted people like Ana Cocorina, an independent producer from Los Angeles.
One of my favorite festivals to come to.
She primarily focuses on co-productions, but she says that, even in a new emerging market like Brazil, co-productions still have their challenges.
It is challenging. Anytime you have a co-production, you have a different set of rules and regulations you have to all put together. So it hasn't been easy. I don't think it's impossible, but it requires a lot of work.
But challenges aside, Ana is still actively doing projects in Brazil. As she points out, in order for these co-productions to really work, there needs to be a creative force and passion behind them. This is key.
There's such thing as soft money tourism. When people just pool countries together just to get access to subsidies and finance the film that way. And if you just piecemeal it like that, it never works because something is bound to go wrong. There has to be a strong creative reason why you're going to a certain country.
Ana explains why she's come to Brazil.
For me, there is a reason. I am producing a film now that is set in Rio. It's an English language film, but it takes place in Rio. So I can't go anywhere else. Rio has a very distinct look, so it's very hard to cheat. So I have no choice but come here and figure out a way to do a co-production.
But even though her film is helping to boost the city's image internationally, her production has been facing the typical Brazil cost.
It's challenging because some of the elements are from countries where the treaty has not been signed. For instance, my director is British and my producer is British. And I know last year, there was a treaty in agreed upon with the United Kingdom, with Ancine. It's been a year now, it hasn't been signed. And, you know, we're waiting for, I'm hoping that it's going to be ratified, but still, it's in, stuck in Brazilian parliament somewhere.
But with just over 10 international co-production treaties signed, Brazil is still looking to expand its market to partner with even more countries. And with lots of stories to be told within Brazil, Ana Cocorina sees that Brazil will benefit by becoming even more international.
I think Brazilian film industry is very sophisticated. It's very good. There's a lot of talent here. I think there are a lot of very good filmmakers and storytellers, and I think it will benefit from becoming more international.
Growth in Brazil's film and television industry is clear here at Festival do Rio. With impressive front office results, so to speak, with screenings of high quality films and with back office workings going on simultaneously at Rio Market, Festival do Rio offers both entertainment to the mainstream and business to film and television professionals.
Uau, o cinema brasileiro não tem tela.
But with bureaucracy that's known to drag on for months and sometimes even years, and with still not the right amount of funding to produce large-scale productions within Brazil, it's clear that Brazil wants to boost its already growing audiovisual market, but that the only way to do that is with funding coming from abroad in the form of international co-productions. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. And after the break, I'm joined by art writer Sarah Thornton, who's here to tell us about her new book, 33 Artists in 3 Acts.
Food on film, we travel to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stallholders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market Value, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now we welcome back one of the best art writers in the world. Sarah Thornton wrote the best-selling 7 Days in the Art World a few years ago and is back this month with a follow-up that takes as its cue The Cult of the Artist, and it's called 33 Artists in 3 Acts. She starts with Marcel Duchamp's quote, "I don't believe in art, I believe in the artist," and runs from there, all over the world too, from Ai Weiwei's studio in Beijing to the ever-tricky-to-find Cindy Sherman in New York City, to Jeff Koons just down the road, and Damien Hirst too, in Devonshire and in Doha. Why? To figure out how they work, what they think about when they think about the artist and their changed status, from the garret to the boardroom, it seems. Here is Sarah Thornton.
I think there's a big gap between the art world and the general public about what an artist is. The general public tends to confuse artists with craftsmen. Do-it-yourself people getting mucky with paint all by themselves in a lonely studio. The art world knows that contemporary artists are more ideas people who could be delegating the execution of the work and may not even see it until it arrives at the gallery, but they thought about it and attended to the details in a different kind of way.
So this is a strange thing. This is where the artist went from, as you said, this kind of starving garret in this kind of romantic painting we all have in our heads, to kind of a bit of a tabloid superstar, someone for whom multi-zero prices follow them around. This is kind of completely changed. It's almost that they're practitioners or they're consultants to the art world, in a sense.
Absolutely, like architects or film directors. And there's romances on all different levels. I mean, the romance of the art world is that it's all about the work and that the artist and the way they behave and their persona is irrelevant to serious people and serious art fans. But actually, when you start looking at it, when you talk to artists with high degrees of recognition, they'll disagree.
And it's an interesting way. You set out in the introduction your idea for this thing. You meet 33 artists in three acts. Maybe we can go on to talk about the way that the book's arranged in a minute. But essentially you said, I was looking for great artists, but also interesting artists, artists that are interesting to interview and shine a light on their work, but mostly maybe on the practices of the art world. And you say that it was a bit like a casting couch, that people would kind of be rejected if they weren't maybe soundbitey enough. Talk us through how this process worked, because there's obviously some very strong characters, Jeff Koons, Ai Weiwei, Demian Hirst, some of the big boys and girls are in this book. You probably won't tell us who you cut, but maybe tell us about the audition process.
Yes, I wouldn't want to tell you about who I cut. I actually do try to avoid the couch, although casting is definitely being part of the process. You know, I interviewed 130 different artists, and there are a lot of actual superstars on the cutting room floor. I was looking for people who did art that was relevant to me in the book, but also people who could talk about it as well. I mean, I do have a few taciturn painters in the book, but for the most part, you know, the book is biased towards the verbose. You know, some of the big gals in the book, we might say, Cindy Sherman, yeah. Marina Abramović, Yayoi Kusama, not all of them are easy interviewees. Cindy Sherman, it doesn't really like to give interviews, but eventually relinquished. And in the end, actually, I got to see her twice, and she has two scenes in the book. And Yayoi Kusama, of course, you know, spends her evenings in an insane asylum across the street from her studio. And there's a bit of a language gap. Yeah. But still, it was amazing the kind of things she ended up saying that kind of shone through, especially when I had my tape recordings retranscribed and reinterpreted.
Okay, so this is getting the subtlety of the Japanese.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. And, you know, Japanese etiquette is such that the interpreter in the room would often minimize her eccentricities. And so having it reinterpreted was a revelation.
And it's an interesting thing to sort of take this approach to sort of get the artist to talk about it. People often talk on behalf of artists, curators talk on behalf of artists, press releases talk on behalf of artists, and hopefully work talks on behalf of artists. But you've totally zeroed in on the personalities, the makers themselves. Who did you really get on with? We've both spent some time with Demian Hirst, and that he stars in the last chapter of your book. And you have an interesting but a spiky relationship with him, I think. But who would you go for a beer with?
I mean, Damien perhaps might have preferred not to be in the book. And
but they're illuminating and fascinating chapters. I think he'd love what he said in there. I mean,
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. I hope he would. Let's see. I guess there are a couple of artists that actually influenced the shape of the book. And one of them was Maurizio Catalan. I talked to him a lot during the early stages of the book and would bounce ideas off of him. And so each act is structured around these antagonists, these, you know, opposing pairs of artists. So when I came up with the idea of juxtaposing Ai Weiwei with Jeff Koons, it was in a conversation with Maurizio, who kind of went, you know, lifted his finger and looked at me like, ah, you know, aha, I think you've got it. And then we had an amusing conversation about who I might juxtapose him with. And during that conversation, I didn't resolve it. But in the end, I juxtaposed him with an entire family because Act Two is called Kinship. And so Maurizio Catalan and his brothers in crime, two curators, Francesco Bonomi and Massimiliano Gioni, are compared with the Dunham-Simmons family. So Carol Dunham is a painter. His wife, Laurie Simmons, is a photographer. And during the course of the book, one of their daughters became very famous, Lena Dunham, and then her sister, Grace, also makes an appearance. I have both the girls commenting on growing up in an artist community in Brooklyn and being the daughters of artists. And so with that family, I get into the nitty-gritty of competition and collaboration and muse or non-muse-like relationships.
And Damien Hirst, interestingly, I think in that chapter, and I'm quoting him, he says, I can see why collectors buy art. It's fucking addictive, he says. Right, which I can imagine him saying that. And did you get that sentiment that maybe this kind of new kind of super artist class that you portrayed in this book find the collecting as interesting as the making, the kind of scanning the world for their contemporaries, their counterparts, their friends and enemies, perhaps, that they do see themselves maybe as pawns in some mega bucks chess game?
It's funny, I don't see those artists as pawns at all. They're much more like queens, technically, right, in the way they can move around the board. At a certain point, they amass enough power and flexibility and mobility that they're the chess piece that makes the most sense is a queen.
You get the feeling from some of those well-known names that they've got a patter for you, you know.
And you have to break through the patter.
Jeff Koons is a very difficult man to interview, isn't he? He's the opposite of Damien Hirst, but you wonder, there's an emollience there that's kind of tough to break the pattern there on Jeff Koons, isn't it?
Jeff kind of got used to me asking the same question 3 or 4 times and just kind of like looking at him pleadingly going, come on, Jeff, you can answer this question for me. I know you can. And he's actually a very sweet man, and he would get irritated, but he'd still be kind of indulgent. And oftentimes I would be reporting, let's say, for The Economist at the same time, so he couldn't kick me out.
That was Sarah Thornton, whose brilliant new book, 33 Artists in 3 Acts, is out now, published by Granta. Coming up in part 2, more of that soothing session from Rue Paines. We hear about a new venture here in London aiming to get people listening to music as it should be listened to. And we discover the needle-eye-sized wonders of micro-sculptor Willard Wigan. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Pounds, on Monocle 24. More of that Midori House session first. Rue Paines is in and playing a few tracks from his record Little Giants. We'll hear from Rue in a few minutes. But first, here he is with Silver Moon.
Down by the waters where I once dreamed, beneath the silver moon, you'll find me. My heart a pilgrim, my mind a slave, for my eyes can't stand to see the light of day. Cause life is lost without love, wouldn't you say? I wish you'd follow me to my peace. Lend me your hands, I'm bringing you from your knees. My love is faithful and your love is true, and I know the silver moon will shine for you. Oh, I know the silver moon will shine for you.
Paines, thank you for a fantastic session. I think you just hypnotised a group of people in the middle of their working day. Let's talk about your background. What was your first memory of music?
I can't say that there was like a moment where I started like listen to music or anything. At the moment, I still don't listen to a whole lot of music. I just started writing. I think I always liked reading, and that led on to writing poetry, and then that kind of led on to arts and that kind of stuff. And then when I got to school, I kind of found that I was quite good at trumpet. I couldn't read music, so my teacher kind of forced me to improvise because he was like, you're way better at improvising, which said to me that perhaps I should go into writing improvisations, which then went into picking up a guitar and writing songs and then bringing poetry in.
So let's talk about when you say you don't listen to music, is that to just sort of try and keep yourself pure of other influences, or you're just not interested in what other people are doing?
No, I am interested. I think there's a lot of great music out there. And when I say I don't listen, I mean, I just don't have like an iPod or anything like that. But obviously I tune in every now and then and like love listening to other people's stuff. I think what happens is that whenever I'm feeling musical, I start to write. So it kind of just substitutes it quite often. But then, as you say, sometimes it's quite nice to not have too many other people's thoughts running around your own head, especially when you're creating something. And this first album, I really wanted to make sure that it was me. So there's not a whole lot of influences that have gone into it apart from my own life and things around me.
So you've got a lovely sounding 12-string guitar. And that, particularly the 12-string, has got this sort of very open, ringing, jangly tone, which kind of lends itself to these sort of one chord, you know, very meditational songs. Do you think if you were to start changing instruments, you'd find some different inspiration writing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've started playing piano and a whole bunch of things. I like to tinker around on lots of different instruments, and I think it does change the way that you write, but I still think there's a continuum in the fact that it's me writing them. So the style doesn't change a huge amount maybe, but definitely I find it easy to open new corridors of thought by just changing on different instruments. I think the drop tuning on the guitar, that was quite apparent today because I only brought that guitar and my capo was broken. So I played a bunch of songs that are actually, they're modal and they're in drop tuning. And as you say, like, I really enjoyed finding that tuning on that 12 string because it just gives it a lot of body. And because of the nature of the 12 string, you get lows, you get highs, and you can create really natural melodies from it just because you don't have to think so much about chord shapes, but you think more about the melody of where you move your fingers. And so I found that really helpful.
Oh, it sounded absolutely fantastic. Let's just touch on the recording of this album, because you did a fairly stripped down job on this at your home in the countryside.
Yeah. We never actually planned on doing it at home. We thought about several places, but my producer came down to visit and then walked into like one of the little rooms that there is in the house with a wooden floor. And he's like, "This is the place." I think it just had like an unusually nice sound for strings. And so it kind of all came together. But I'm really glad it did happen that way because it's nice to play your album where you wrote it. I guess it's quite stripped back, but also we really love writing quite big strings parts. So these songs are singer-songwriter by nature, but I love writing strings parts. And so the arrangements, I guess, are layered up with quite a lot of different things. So it's hopefully quite a classical sound.
That was Rue Payne speaking to Paul Noble, and his new record, Little Giants, is out this week. For more on what Rue's up to, head to ruepaynes.co.uk. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. Now to New York to meet a mighty man making miniature models. Willard Wigan is a British sculptor with an extremely steady hand. In fact, in order to do the work he does, he has to enter a meditative state to slow down his heart rate and avoid the tiniest twitches in his body. This might sound rather dramatic, but it's required for him to make intricate sculptures that can only be viewed through a microscope. These minute figures fit in the eye of a needle, and his designs include fairy tale characters, scenes from outer space, and even a commission from the Queen to make a minuscule coronation crown for her Diamond Jubilee. On a recent trip to New York, Willard met with Monocle's Megan Billings to get down to the minutiae.
I was born in England, and I discovered I had a talent for making small things because of my limitations in academics. You know, I think I was sort of driven to find what I had. And this is what I had, this talent. And that happened when the dog dug a hole in the ground. We used to have a little dog. And all these ants came out the ground. I lived in a little fantasy world. I thought ants were like people that could speak. And, you know, I thought they lived in little houses. And so I thought all these ants were sort of traumatized because they had nowhere to live. All their houses were destroyed. So I decided to help them by building some houses for ants. And how I did that, I found my dad's razor blade. It was a broken piece of razor blade, and I got some splinters of wood and started slicing the splinters of wood. As I was slicing them, I was actually constructing small houses. They were like little log cabins, you know, like little apartments type of thing, you know. And then what made it really happen for me is when my mother seen me making these little houses for the ants. When she saw it, it kind of stunned her into silence. She was overwhelmed because she saw these little houses and she couldn't understand how I made them, you know. And the first thing she said to me was, if you make them smaller, your name will get bigger.
Can you tell me a bit about the process for working? And from what I understand, you even slow your heartbeat, and that's very much part of the process.
Yeah, well, you know, years passed on, you know, I've evolved and moved on, and throughout my whole life, I was just developing my skills, and I knew that as they got smaller, I knew that I had to control my breathing. I knew that if I didn't hold my breath, it would cause slight tremors. If I didn't feel my pulse, that would be detrimental to the work. So what I did, I started to work between the heartbeat. So when I could feel my heart as it stopped, and then I started to cut very, very slowly. But the tools were very important. So now I'm using broken shards of diamond, which are inserted into the end of a syringe, a very fine syringe. They look like little bee stings. And I also use acupuncture needles, which I cut the point of the needle off and insert it into the end of a matchstick.
Is it trial and error? How did you decide that diamonds would be the right tool?
Well, diamonds are very hard, you see. So if I used to smash little diamonds up, and then, well, I do, that's what I do, I smash them. And then when you look underneath the microscope, you get these little shards, and you can find the sharpest end. And that's what I use to cut. So what I'm doing, I'm sort of selecting them underneath the microscope, and I may see one and say, that's the one I'm going to use. But then you have to pick it up because it's so fine, you know. So some of the tools are quite sophisticated, intricate, very hard, just as, well, not quite as complicated as the sculptures, but you have to make individual kind of tools like little tweezers and little hooks and you know, little knives and all types of things, hooks to hold and manipulate, you know, the material that you're going to carve, if you're going to carve gold, so it'll hold it in position while you cut. Your dexterity and your skill and having the patience is the most important thing. And also having that duration, you know, not allow your mental thoughts to, you know, because it affects you, because it's driving you insane, you see, because you've got these little tiny sculptures and anything could happen. You could inhale one or something, or just a pulse on your finger can cause a little catapult action and then disappear.
You have made the smallest sculpture in the world. Would you tell me about that?
All my sculptures are the smallest in the world, but I decided to go even smaller by beating my own record. I wanted to challenge myself just to see how small I could go. I was shaving, and one of the little stubbles from my chin, which was quite invisible to look at the naked eye, and it was stuck between my fingerprint. So I put my finger underneath the microscope, and so I retrieved this microscopic piece of stubble. So I decided to drill a hole down the middle and make it transparent. So I kept thinking, what do I need to put inside? Because I wanted it to be like a journey to my success. I wanted to call it the microscopic journey. So what I did, I decided to think of something that moves, and a motorbike moves. So I put a motorbike in there, and I called it the golden journey. And I wanted it to be a message to let people understand that you never underestimate something that you can't see, because that's where we all came from.
That was Willard Wigan speaking to Monocle's Megan Billings. If you want to check out some of those minuscule sculptures yourself, then head to willard-wigan.com to see if he's exhibiting anywhere near you. After the break, we're going to Spiritland, a snug corner of East London with space to let your ears breathe. All will be revealed.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we're in London for the final part of the show to talk about a new space for listening to music running this autumn. Spiritland is a bold new concept where music meets good food and drink, and most importantly, a really great set of speakers. Perhaps this doesn't make it sound particularly groundbreaking, but whereas London is great for a noisy pub with a well-stocked jukebox or a warehouse DJ spinning the latest house remixes, there is less opportunity to sit back and take the time to have a good old listen. The setting is the Merchant's Tavern, a restaurant recently opened in Shoreditch. Each night, a guest DJ will be on hand to guide drinkers and diners through Spiritland's vast music selection. From rock and roll to reggae to R&B, with a bit of jazz and soul thrown in for good measure, expect the songs you don't usually hear down your local. The vibe is cosy but elegant, the drinks are strong, and the sound is crystal clear. Paul Noble is the brains behind it, and you'll probably recognise his name and the voice as he's a regular contributor to this show. And here he is to tell us a little bit more about Spiritland.
Chase love shadow till the rivers run cold. Hey baby, get it up for love. Get it up for love. Get it up for love.
The name is from the Elky Brooks B-side of 1977, as you'll know.
Everyone will know that.
Everyone knows that tune.
Yeah.
And I just had an idea to sort of restore some of the dignity back to the music industry, which has largely gone down the toilet. You've either got people listening to sort of poor quality streaming audio on their computer the size of a peanut, well, you know, with a speaker the size of a peanut, or, you know, everyone's just sort of abandoned music. And the idea of Spiritland is to sort of reclaim some of that magical, mystical, goosebumps connection to music you had in the old days.
And this is an interesting thing because this is essentially a listening room, isn't it? That's been set up in a restaurant in East London. And it's for people to go along. It's kind of like the ultimate dinner party scenario, right? You've got great food. And then in the meantime, while you're maybe waiting for your food to arrive or waiting to get your table, you've got this amazing hi-fi system with these amazing speakers, and you've got some fairly prodigious talents spinning discs. This is kind of my rough around the edges description of what Spiritland entails, but maybe you can fill us in on the details.
No, that's pretty spot on. I mean, there's, you know, my two great loves of food and music. So often people get it wrong. It's either so backgroundy and so inoffensive, and, you know, I'm thinking of Nouvelle Vague pittering away in the background, or it's just too loud. Then everyone starts talking louder and you get indigestion. And so this is doing something in a much more considered way of, you know, we've got 100 years of music history. We've got rock and jazz and soul and country and all this fantastic music, which people only really listen to at home. And when you go out, it's either DJs playing the same old kind of guilty pleasures wedding set, which I've heard 100 times, or it's just so backgroundy that it's almost pointless. So this is doing something, you know, it's at the mellow end of the spectrum. There's no dance floor, there's no mixing, and there's a very, very high-end audio system, the kind of which you'd only usually find in the house of an audiophile or a millionaire.
Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day.
How does it work? Are people bringing in LPs to play, or are people not DJing in the sense of mixing between songs and mixing into songs, but are they playing sort of their favourite tracks? Are people doing nights in terms of genre? How's it going to work?
I'm leaving it quite open-ended. So some people have come to me and said, I just want to play a night of Prince, but only the album stuff, the slow jams, the productions and collaborations. Other people are doing just Blue Note, so just a night of jazz on one particular label. Some other people have said, you know what, I'm really actually country is my thing, but not the big hat country, the sort of mournful tears in your sarsaparilla,
yeah,
old time country and Americana. So some people will be just playing tracks. If you want to play an album, or if you want to play a side of an album, that's fine. I'm fine with silences. And it's also a reaction to our current pace of life, which is everyone's unbelievably busy. We're all distracted 100% of the time with our phones and tablets. And this is a very elegant, sort of darkly lit space to just come and have a drink and enjoy some music and maybe some food in a sort of more considered way than just let's stick on some tunes in the background.
Come on up to Spiritland, where dreams never
That was Paul Noble, and Spiritland is happening every day between now and New Year at the Merchant's Tavern in Shoreditch in London. Head to spiritland.club to find out who's playing. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, I'll meet the KLF's Jimmy Corti at his artist's studio. And over in Austria, we'll be taking a spin of a sound art installation or on a merry-go-round. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Boundwell. My producer was Holly Fisher, talking of Willard Wigan and his steady hands. None are steadier than hers on the production tiller. Time for one final song this week from Rue Paynes. Here he is with I'll Move Mountains. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Time will heal those broken eyes, fashion you a face from your disguise. Love never held that lonely heart, the world a hostile city from the start. And no one's towing your slipstream, you're a tiger, so your wild dreams is true. And the leaden sky is drawing in, but I'll move mountains. Oh, cry, my friend, no more. You've seen your stars aligning, I'm sure. You etched all of your circles in the sand. Now your hope's horizons are at hand. A light against the darkened skies. Your truth must outshine all the lies it seems. But from the outside looking in, they say I'll move mountains. Pack on your heels, it's after you. Love is not a word that the world knows, whilst fighting for survival from its foes. And some things take a life to learn, your innocence forced to discern, it seems. But from the outside looking in, I say I'll move mountains. Ah.